This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good morning. We're going to get started with Grand Rounds, and our speaker today is Dr. Thomas Coates, who's a Distinguished Professor of Medicine and the Michael and Sue Steinberg Distinguished Professor of Global AIDS Research within the Division of Infectious Diseases here in the Department of Medicine. He is the Executive Director of the UCLA Center for World Health within the David Geffen School of Medicine and UCLA Health. He also leads the UCLA program in global health within the Division of Infectious Diseases and is the co-director of the University of California Global Health Initiative. He was at UCSF and in many leadership positions until 2013 when he joined UCLA. Dr. Coates received his MA in psychology from San Jose State University and his PhD in counseling psychology from Stanford. His areas of interest and expertise are in global clinical trials related to HIV. He received funding from USAID and WHO for the various randomized controlled trials that he was involved in various countries such as Kenya, Tanzania, Trinidad, and recently completed a 48-community randomized clinical trial in South Africa, Zimbabwe, Tanzania, Thailand, and continues to do so. His work takes him to Uganda, Peru, and China. He's won multiple awards. The thing that caught my attention was that in 2003, Dr. Thomas Coates Day was declared in San Francisco by Mayor Willie Brown in honor of his departure from there. He's also been elected to the Institute of Medicine, where he serves on the board on global health and serves on the Strategic Advisory Committee for HIV for the World Health Organization. He was a member and served as chair of the Behavioral and Social Consequences of HIV/AIDS Study Section at the NIH. He has authored 273-plus peer-reviewed articles and 45 book chapters. And the title of his talk, at least on his slide, says Saving Lives and Improving Health by Investing in People. So, Dr. Coates.
Thank you, Dr. Davis Carr. What you didn't say was that Willie Brown declared the day in honor of the fact that I was leaving. They were.
I did say that.
You did say that. So it's a pleasure to speak to you this morning and talk to you about some very exciting things that are happening in global health. And what I want to emphasize is that we are on the verge of, I think, some great things happening in the next 20 years. So I'm going to talk about maternal and child health, what we can accomplish next. The pivotal publication came out in 1993 when Dr. Larry Summers, former president of Harvard University, was president of the World Bank. And they issued a World Development Report, the first of its kind, because the World Bank, as you know, invests mostly in infrastructure, bridges, dams, roads, those kinds of things that are intended to improve the economy of a country. Well, for the first time, they laid out the assertion that it was a good thing to invest in health. Not only because we care about health, but that health and improvements in health are intimately linked to economic development. I want to give you a little background on how much money is spent on overseas development assistance. And in 2010, it was about $150 billion from all sources, U.S., European, Asian sources of the high-income countries. And as you can see that it's spent on various things like debt relief with a huge bump in 2006. You can see that there's money spent on economic infrastructure, government, and civil society. And the bottom blue line is health, which tends to be about 12% of overall overseas development assistance spending. So again, from all sources, about $18 billion up to 2010. The biggest increases, as you can see here, were made in HIV/AIDS. And the response to HIV/AIDS that began really after the Durban AIDS conference, the first conference held in a middle-income or low-income country at that time, certainly in a country hard hit by the HIV epidemic, said that it shouldn't matter where you live. If you live in a low or middle-income country, you shouldn't die sooner from HIV for lack of medication. And that really got the conscience of the world. And hence, you see the very large increase in spending on HIV/AIDS. This is another way of looking at it. And over the years, between 2009 and 2010, again, HIV/AIDS was the largest increase. You see down here, family planning, reproductive health got a very small increase. Other infectious diseases actually got a decrease. Nutrition, again, a very small increase. So HIV/AIDS has led the way. The question is, what can come next? Not surprisingly, most of the money was targeted to sub-Saharan Africa, which has about two-thirds of the world's HIV cases. But there is an alarming trend, and that is it's decreasing. And if we look at U.S. global health funding, which tends to be, as you can see, if the overall is about 18.4, which tends to be about half of what the world gives, the 2014 president's request is only a slight increase over 2013. And as you see, 2013 was a decrease from 2012. So given the current budget situation, we're at kind of a steady state. Again, if we look at the top 10 donors, the United States gives the lion's share. The other countries then peg their contribution to the United States share. And if the other countries don't come up to their level, the United States decreases its share. So there's this kind of international jockeying that goes on to determine how much is going to be given. I always like to show this slide because the other way of looking at it is per 1 million GDP, and the little country of Luxembourg, which has about 450,000 people, maybe includes Westwood and maybe Brentwood and a few other neighborhoods. Actually, we have, 45,000 people on UCLA campus, so it's 10% of the population of Luxembourg. But they still give the most. And then you see Denmark, UK, Ireland, Norway, Sweden, and the United States actually coming ahead of Netherlands, Belgium, and Canada. But people are saying, well, we should increase the amount that we give per GDP. Now, as you've seen, a large chunk of the money has been spent on AIDS. And The Economist, a couple of years ago, published this, how 5 million lives have been saved and a plague could now be defeated. Now, the place where it mostly needs to be defeated, and I think this map tells it all, that most of the world, it's a concentrated epidemic. That is, it's among high-risk groups, typically men who have sex with men, injection drug users, and commercial sex workers. The generalized epidemic is principally in eastern and southern sub-Saharan Africa, with the highest burden being in southern sub-Saharan Africa. Botswana, South Africa, Lesotho, Swaziland, Mozambique. These are the countries hardest hit, Namibia to a certain extent as well. The countries of eastern Africa with a generalized epidemic, but not with quite the same level of concentration. Now, again, the data are good. All of this effort has yielded something. And we have, with estimated national incidence declines between 2001 and 2011, several countries in the greater than 50% decrease in national incidence. Countries like Haiti, India, Malawi, Namibia, Thailand, Zambia, Zimbabwe. Even Zimbabwe, with all of its governmental disruption, has had decreases. Countries like South Africa decreasing between 25 and 49%. Other countries like Mozambique doing the same thing. Kenya, Jamaica. So the money has been well spent. The money is making an impact. But you can also see the difficulties in continuing that impact. Probably the best thing that we have right now that is close to a vaccine is voluntary male circumcision, medical male circumcision. The three clinical trials that demonstrated the efficacy of medical male circumcision in decreasing acquisition of HIV showed a 60% efficacy. As the cohorts have been followed, the efficacy is also shown to increase, up to 75% after 3 years in South Africa. The three studies were done in Kenya, Uganda, and South Africa, the three randomized controlled trials, and they all came out with the same result. Now, there are other benefits from voluntary male circumcision, most notably decrease in acquisition and then transmission of HPV and a resulting decrease in cervical cancer, which is a terrible scourge in places like South Africa and other places with heterosexually transmitted infections. The problem is the goal had been targeted about 20 million medical male circumcisions by 2016. Unfortunately, we're not even near. We actually have only gotten up to about this point with about 5 million. And so reaching these goals is very difficult. The other strategy that we have is treatment as prevention. And that is, it's been demonstrated in a randomized clinical trial that if you treat the infected partner when CD4s fall at or below 350, that it reduces transmission to the uninfected partner by 96%. So that's a marvelous finding. The problem is, in that clinical trial, they were able to demonstrate that one-third of the infections came from outside the relationship. These were discordant couples randomized to one of two conditions. So it means you need to treat whole communities. And when you look at it community-wide, and there have been some naturalistic studies in the area covered by the Africa Center, the infection was 34% lower with 30 to 40% ART coverage. It was 26% lower in an observational study among discordant couples in China. We didn't see a difference in Uganda. And we see HIV infections continuing to rise in highly treated MSM communities in developed countries. And even with 85% of people on ART at CD4 at 350 in Swaziland, there's a measured HIV incidence of 2.4% on top of a 26% adult prevalence. So these are not easy interventions to implement, given the fact that you have to do an entire population. So full implementation, we have about 11 million people on, or about 9.7 million people on ART now worldwide. To get to everybody with CD4s less than 200 would take 11 million. If we went to 350, it would be 17 million. If we went to 21 million and included ART for serodiscordant couples and pregnant women, it would be 21 million, 26 million, and 32 million. So we do have a ways to go. The progress is good, but how do we get there? And the other way it's measured is in terms of this treatment cascade, whereas in the United States, in most jurisdictions, if you can enumerate and you have 100% of your HIV-infected people, and this is the United States estimates, we only have 28% with viral suppression. In Western Africa, it's only 10%. So the problem is we've made advances, but it still requires a lot of behavior, and it still requires daily medication. And so we really need to keep pushing to the next generation before we're going to end AIDS. Now I want to turn to the second part of my talk and talk about some progress that has been made over the past 20 years in reductions in mortality, and especially in reductions in maternal and child mortality. There was established at the University of Washington, with funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. And Bill Gates funded this because he felt very strongly that we can't know where we're going unless we know where we've been. And good measurement is essential. Now, there have been some phenomenal changes. In the last, between 1990 and 2011, the last 21 years, you see in 1990, 58% of the world's population lived in low-income countries. In 2011, it's been reduced to 11.7%, and a goodly number have moved into the lower middle income and the upper middle income brackets. This has been a phenomenal change in the economies of the world. Very importantly, this is male mortality and female mortality, and this is declines in the last 21 years. And what we see down here, worldwide, now this is taking all countries together, what we see down here, particularly in the very early ages, is a 60 to 70% decline in deaths among infants. And this has been brought about both by increases in the economy and improvements in health care. And you see that this goes all the way down the line. Now, of course, these differences, these changes, are not evenly spread throughout the population. But what you see, so I'll define this, the frontier is the best performing country. And this is the longest female life expectancy at birth. So what we see between 1910 and 2010 is a gradual increase. We see this for the United States. We see it for Mexico, whose life expectancy has climbed incredibly. China has made incredible increases. We see it for India. We see it even for Ethiopia, which has been hard hit by the HIV epidemic. So we see it in a variety of countries, and that's important to acknowledge. Now, this is another interesting way to look at it. This is the mean age at death in 1970. This is the mean age at death in 2010. And what you see, all of these countries, the curve has shifted. Obviously, in the very high-income countries, it's moved from about 70 up to between 75 and 80 up here. But even in places like Southern Latin America, there have been rapid increases from about 50 here to about 70 here. In tropical Latin America, it's moved from about 30 to about the mid-60s. In Southeast Asia, the same kinds of changes. But even in Sub-Saharan Africa, we've seen shifts. So for here, Western Sub-Saharan Africa, it was at around 16 or 17. It's now gotten up to 25. Now, obviously, we're not satisfied with 25, but these are remarkable changes in the last 20 years. Again, the reasons for death are still very different. And this is a trend about which we're all well aware. And that is in the very low-income countries, there's a high burden of communicable diseases, but there's also a high burden of non-communicable diseases and injuries. And so what they have is the double burden. When they move to lower middle income, the burden of non-communicable diseases becomes higher. And then for upper middle income and high income countries, it's almost all non-communicable diseases. So as people survive the infectious diseases, the communicable diseases, it moves to the non-communicable diseases. This is another way of looking at it, maternal mortality in adolescence. And we look at 15 to 19 years in Mexico. 2000 to 2004, it was 43%. 2005 to 2009, 36%. Improvements in Russia, South Africa, even with the HIV epidemic, and in the USA. So these are the percent of Asia-Pacific maternal mortality rates ratios in four countries. So we see improvements in most countries, with even in South Africa, with HIV/AIDS. Another way of looking at it is decline in mortality. These are data for China. And again, you see these are declines. So you see a huge decline in the early ages and some declines even throughout the ages. Now, this is a little complicated, but I really wanted to show you this because it shows in 1990 and 2010 the reasons for death in China. Things like lower respiratory infections move from first to ninth. Neonatal encephalopathy moves from seventh down to 19th. Preterm birth complications moves from about 9 down to about 19. HIV/AIDS moves up, but there's so much movement down. And then the things that move up are stroke, ischemic heart disease, COPD, which is a big issue in China, road injury, lung cancer, liver cancer, stomach cancer, and self-harm remains the same. So there's been this in one country in China represents the shift from communicable to non-communicable diseases and the increase in longevity. This is the unfinished agenda in child survival. So for the last 15 to 20 years, the World Health Agenda has been driven by what are called the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals. And these are to be reached in 2015. And what you see on the left is the relative reduction. The goal was a relative reduction of around 40%. All of these countries down here didn't reach that relative reduction. These countries up here did. And you see some very interesting examples. Rwanda, way over here. Very impressive decreases. Now, this is a country that 20 years ago this year, 1994, suffered a terrible genocide. We just had President Kagame here, and then we had the health minister, Dr. Agnes Binagwaho. And they have made health a priority. And the reason they have made health a priority is because they see health as crucial to the benefit of their population and to their economic development. The other thing that's interesting about a country like Rwanda is that 64% of its parliament are women. So they have a very strong interest in maternal and child health, and they have made this one of their priorities. But you also see Malawi, very poor country here. You see Ethiopia, Tanzania, Bangladesh, Nepal, and then countries like this, China, Turkey, Egypt, Mexico. But then there are countries that should have come along but didn't, and for various reasons can't. Of course, you expect countries where there's war like South Sudan to have difficulties, Ghana, but then India has moved up in economic development, but of course it's uneven. Iraq and Cameroon, pummeled by war, and of course Somalia, which really has no government whatsoever. Now, one of the Lancet reports talks about advancing social and economic development by investing in women and children's health, a new global investment framework. This is kind of a complicated slide, and it'll be on the PowerPoint. But what you can see is that the cost of investments results in lives saved, which results in improved nutrition and morbidity averted. You've got a healthier population living longer that's more economically productive. So the report from the Lancet Commission stipulates that if you invest in health, you get an 8 to 20-fold increase in GDP output. When we look at total fertility, we see that total fertility remains high in Africa. Pretty much in other regions of the world, it has leveled off, the high points being about 2.5, but what they're projecting is by 2035, it could be down to two children per family for most regions of the world. The difficulty will be to make that happen in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, what this group talks about is an essential package, and that package includes family planning and accessible to everyone. Now, the interesting thing, I think about this analogy now. So if we look at gay rights and women's reproductive health rights, we've had this incredible advance in gay rights. And somehow with reproductive health rights, it feels like two steps forward, one and a half steps back, sometimes three steps back. So now, before the Supreme Court, once again, we have the Hobby Lobby case. And it's, you say, why are we talking about this in 2014? Wasn't this settled? Didn't we agree that reproductive health rights is a good thing? And the former governor of Arkansas, Huckabee, you know, some say it was a gaffe. I don't think it was a gaffe at all. When speaking before an assembly of Republicans, he said, well, liberals just want contraceptives for women because they think women can't control their libido. People think that. I think he actually thought that. And he thinks that, and he thinks that's right. So this has been a much more difficult slog and a much more difficult thing to advance. And I think where our efforts need to go, a lot of efforts need to go in ensuring reproductive health rights worldwide access. Package two, maternal and newborn health, as a complex of things that need to ensure reductions in maternal and newborn mortality. Third one, malaria. Malaria, it both kills as well as prevents growth. HIV. The secretary, I almost said President Clinton, Secretary Clinton, declared when she was Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State rather, in her talk to the NIH in 2011, an AIDS-free generation. And what she was really referring to is the fact that we now have at our disposal the ability to prevent transmission from mother to child. And it's a matter of implementing it and getting it in place. Immunization, we know, is crucial. And finally, child health. Now, if we put all those packages together, and what they show is the potential for maternal deaths to be prevented in 2015 up to 2035, with the greatest impact in the lower middle-income countries and the low-income countries. And we see the same thing for child deaths prevented. Now, the cost is not trivial. In terms of U.S. billions, and this is years, we see quite a bit of cost, up to $30 billion a year, for all of these things that will take to implement this basic package: commodities, inpatient care, cash transfers, improving adolescents' accessibility, reproductive and maternal child health, governance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not a trivial cost, but it's a very cost-effective cost. Now, the other report that came out of the Lancet Commissions was Global Health 2035. And one of the major themes was this grand convergence, that as in the last 20 years, we've seen this shift from low-income countries into low-, middle-, and middle-income countries, we can see that shift continue. So there could be no countries in the low-income group in the next 20 years. When you see countries like Vietnam emerging into middle-income status, when you see Rwanda with their goal and on track to become a middle-income country by 2020, this is very possible. But what this would require is to double investments in low- and middle-income countries to $6 billion a year. This doesn't include the essential maternal child survival package. Improvements in health increases GDP. Fiscal policies can be used to control risk factors. And progressive universalism is a pathway toward universal health coverage. And they talk about an essential package that would make the difference. I encourage everyone to look up this report and download it. It's free online. On April 15th, we'll be talking about this with leaders from the field. Victoria Fan, who's a research fellow at the Center for Global Development, will be talking about strategic development investments. Richard Horton, the editor-in-chief of The Lancet, will talk about policy changes that need to happen. Now, Richard's a very clever guy. He scooped us. So, you know, the trend in the field is global health. Well, we named our center the Center for World Health. And then he sent something out last week talking about planetary health. Well, I'm jealous. And so I've called him to task on that, and I've said, we're going to make ourselves the Center for Intergalactic Health and bring Elon Musk in to help us do that. Ambassador Eric Goosby, who is the former PEPFAR ambassador, is now returned to UCSF, will talk about health diplomacy and how health can become the leveling factor. We had a very stirring talk last night by Terry McCarthy, the president of the Los Angeles World Affairs Council, a journalist who spent many years covering various wars. And the question was, what can we do to prevent war? Well, health diplomacy is one of those things. It is the leveling factor. John Cohen, a journalist, will talk about aspirations for the future. So this will be on April 15th in this auditorium. And that's why when we put the Center for World Health together, we said our goal is to save lives and improve health by investing in people. There are other organizations like the Gates Foundation that is very technology oriented, and that's very important. We think that the answer is people. One of the watchwords in USAID and in overseas development assistance funding is sustainability. Well, how do you sustain things? By having a skilled workforce on the ground that can do the job that's necessary to save lives and improve health. So I want to talk for a few minutes then and close my talk about the Center for World Health and how it is that we at UCLA can contribute to this worldwide effort. We declare our values. We're humanists. We advocate for human rights for all people. We're worldwide. We're interested in lower, middle, and upper income regions alike. And even in upper income regions, we strive to eradicate the world's disparities. Forbes just published a list of the most disparate cities in the United States. San Francisco, even though it revels in its socialist identity, is at the top of the list. And as a former San Franciscan, I say, ha ha. But we're on the list. San Francisco is about, Los Angeles is about sixth. Miami is on the list. Seattle is on the list. So even in very high income places, there's incredible disparity, as you all well know from your clinical practices. We want it to be sustainable. And we think that the sustainability comes in the investment in people. We celebrate diversity. We're not vertical. We don't say, we have the answers, we give them to you, we're horizontal. And, of course, we cherish innovation. Now, what are our priorities? The first one being the Global Health Education Programs. And this is led by Lee Miller in the Department of Pediatrics. And this involves programs for students, programs for residents, programs for fellows and faculty. And I'm really happy that the Department of Pediatrics has supported the development of programs, especially for its residents, with residents going to Mozambique, going to Thailand, China, Peru, and other places. And we think that this is important not only for learning good medicine, but also for becoming better people and understanding, again, how it is that we can contribute to changes around the world. We have student rotations and resident rotations in Malawi in collaboration with Partners in Hope. This is Malawi, one of a very poor country, and it extends down Lake Malawi, surrounded by Mozambique and Zambia and Tanzania. And this is the state of things in the Kamuzu Central Hospital, very desperate situation. It was kind of an irony. The former president of Malawi, who took his governance lessons from Robert Mugabe, his stepbrother, I think, or his brother-in-law or something, in Zimbabwe, had a heart attack. And they rushed him to Kamuzu Central Hospital. There was no epinephrine. There was no oxygen. There was nothing to take care of him, and he died of the heart attack. And that's because he had soaked the health system, and there were no supplies there. So we work with Partners in Hope Medical Center in Lilongwe. This is one of our residents working with a pregnant woman. And we have Project Equip, which is a capacity-building project. This is part of the Obama Health Initiative. And we work with the Ministry of Health in implementing national plans. We strengthen clinical capacity, first in the Christian Health Association of Malawi hospitals and clinics, and then in the central and northern regions. We attempt to eliminate barriers to care, strengthen laboratory and diagnostic capabilities, implement Option B+, which is ART for all HIV pregnant women for life. And we engage in clinically relevant research. And this is our group of people that leads Project Equip. This is Alan Schooley, who is a pediatrician, worked first with the Indian Health Service in New Mexico and then came with us. This is the group of clinical officers who are engaged in the capacity building. This is a house we rent in Malawi to house the residents and students when they come. You're well aware of the program in Mozambique. Lee Miller and Dan Deogarte are off to Mozambique as we speak, somewhere in the air over the Atlantic. And they have established a very strong relationship with the pediatrics department at Eduardo Mondale Hospital and Medical School in Mozambique, and are doing capacity building and strengthening in the pediatrics arena with support from the government, the U.S. government, with support from Anadarko, an oil drilling company, because they found gas in northern Mozambique. And the development of resources is always kind of a mixed blessing. One worries that the development of resources will subvert the economy and will lead to even greater disparity. Angola is a chief example. And it can be good, it can be bad. Botswana is the other kind of example, where when the British left in 1960, they had 3 miles of paved roads, and then they found diamonds. And they have used their resources very wisely to improve the health of the country. This is a training up north where they're teaching the nurse midwives neonatal resuscitation. This is by Emily Hartford, who's a faculty member here in the Department of Pediatrics, but based in Maputo. We also have programs in Cape Town, mostly for emergency medicine, and also a nice affiliation in Durban on the other side of the country, which has a very high prevalence of HIV, probably one of the highest prevalences in the world, and especially when you take into account that Lesotho and Swaziland are located over here, where we do research exchanges and other kinds of exchanges. There's the program in Rio. There's also the program in Porto Alegre that Karen Nielsen and Yvonne Bryson have developed over the years. And then there's Iquitos, where pediatric residents are being sent, which is in the Amazon region. There's Lee Miller on another trip in Iquitos. And as you can see, he's nervously hanging on to these two poles so that he doesn't fall in the water. But that doesn't deter the kids from swimming in this brackish and filthy water. And it's the way people get around. There's Lee and Chris Timchuk from the Department of Medicine actually floating on the river. And so our goal, one of our goals, is to create opportunities for medical students, for residencies, and also eventually to come to a global health fellowship, which we are working on trying to implement. So we spend a lot of time on education and junior faculty development so that we can provide opportunities, and these opportunities are reciprocal. We are identifying resources to bring people from other places. Sometimes that's not so easy if English language is not well-developed, but we also have other kinds of opportunities from the Fogarty International Program, the Fogarty R25. We have the South American Program in HIV research. We have a new grant from the Fogarty to bring scholars from Cambodia. There's a new grant that also Roger Deedles got renewed in his project to bring scholars from China. So this is a great opportunity for us to share with the world what we know. It's a little-known fact that the leader of the HIV program in China is a UCLA graduate. He's a Chinese physician, applied to Roger's program, came here, got his doctorate in public health, went back to China, and over the years implemented probably some of the most progressive programs in the world, with 500 syringe exchanges, the introduction of methadone maintenance, outreach to gay and commercial sex worker groups, outreach to injection drug users, and ART for all HIV-infected people, and the implementation of Option B+. So it's been it's one way we can influence things worldwide. We also believe in strengthening human capital, and this is where we say investing in people, that it requires a skilled and patient-centered workforce. And we look for collaborative medical opportunities for UCLA and partner institutions in advancing medical and surgical care and high-quality, sustainable care addressing local solutions. And the two of these together combine to create the variety of educational offerings that we have. And we talk about reciprocity because it's important that we not only go to other places, but that we also come here. But in going other places, we can also be helpful. So, for example, in Malawi, we're getting very involved in medical education. And we want our residents, when they go, to lecture to the medical students there and prepare lectures to deliver. We want them to conduct case conferences with folks in the residency programs. And this is a way we can contribute back as well as bringing people here. The D43 that Karen Nielsen has and the Brazilian medical scholars training at UCLA for 1 year is another example where several countries, China, Brazil, South Africa, Ecuador, are now offering scholarships to people to come and study in the United States. And to the degree that we can accommodate them in our training centers is another way we build relationships, but we also do capacity building. But that's also health diplomacy, because those relationships last forever. And that's what equalizes and changes the world. World health policy, these are some examples. Malawi, we're involved in the evolution of the national HIV guidelines. China, pivotal in developing China's HIV/AIDS prevention programs. Mozambique, one of the results of a student program in Dan de Ugarte's work has been modification of transfusion guidelines for pediatric surgery. These are examples of policy changes. And finally, we want to do science. And much of the global work has been involved in HIV, and now we want to branch out, cancer being one area, child survival being another area, that we think we can make a difference. And finally, we think it's important to connect worldwide. I think a prime example is the Global Pediatric Radiology Coalition that Dr. Inez Bochat runs, which allows us to connect people worldwide for the purpose of making human connections and technology solutions. So we think that's our contribution to what can happen over the next 20 years. And we think that saving lives and improving health will come by investing in people. Our people here and people elsewhere. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.